Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
I hope you're sitting down for this. George Barna's Cultural Research Center found only 13% of born-again Christians have a biblical worldview. That means there's a huge lack of biblical life essentials in our country. AFA is committed to helping churches ignite a hunger for God. You can be part of that with your gift today, and we'll send you Dr. Alex McFarland's DVD, Do Christians Have Permission to Edit Scripture? Visit afa.net/biblical. afa.net/biblical.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, November 10th, and a lot of news to get to, including a probable resolution to the government shutdown, and we will get to that. But breaking this morning, Trump has pardoned those involved in the 2020 election that were representing him, including the electors, attorneys, and also including me. So Ed Martin, who is an attorney with the DOJ, posted this: breaking, President Trump pardoned the 2020 alternative electors. Thank you, POTUS, for allowing me as U.S. pardon attorney to work with the White House, along with Attorney General Pam Bondi, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, and Solicitor General John Sauer, to achieve your intent. Let their healing begin. Hashtag Federalist74. I think he very, very aptly said that, because a lot of us have gone through a lot more trauma than anyone who is listening really understands. And so I have a lot of thoughts on it, but, you know, maybe a little bit overwhelmed this morning. So to join me to discuss all of this and her thoughts is my very dear friend Cleta Mitchell, who is a former Trump attorney. She also works with the Conservative Partnership Institute on Election Integrity, wrote a fabulous article in The Federalist that was pushing for these pardons to be granted. I know has done a lot of work on advocacy on our behalf. So Cleta, thank you so much, and good morning.
Well, good morning, Jenna. It is really such a great day because President Trump signed the pardon order and pardoned 77 people, 54 of whom were electors and people, attorneys for President Trump, including you and John Eastman and Jeff Clark and Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and two additional lawyers in Georgia. I mean, I had hoped that the White House would have a very big ceremony and bring all the people into one room, one place, because it is hard to describe the extent to which the Biden regime used the power and abused the power of the federal government to indict and try to destroy people like you. Because of your and their association with President Trump. And so I have been, you know, God, people kept asking me, because I was one of President Trump's volunteer attorneys in Georgia in the post-election of 2020, which is where I first encountered you. And I was asked for several years after Fannie Willis, the Democrat prosecutor in Fulton County, Georgia, convened that special grand jury and said she was going to go after people, and then in fact did go after people, including you, and indicted so many people, 18 people plus the president. And people would ask me before that indictment came down if I was worried about being indicted, and I just kept saying it's in God's hands. There's really nothing I can do about it. This is completely bogus. These are fake charges that she's developing, but I can't do anything about that. It's in God's hands. And so for some reason, God has a plan, and I was not indicted. But I said then I was going to do everything that I could do to help right the wrongs and help the people who were indicted in five states. And so I've been working with Ed Martin over the past several months when he went over to the Department of Justice to become the pardon's attorney, among other hats. And we talked about why couldn't we pardon these everybody associated with the Trump campaign. And that was even before we knew, Jenna. We didn't know about Arctic Frost. We didn't know the extent to which this investigation, this sprawling investigation, had been convened by the Biden White House, DOJ, and FBI. And once I started reading all those documents, I knew that we were on the right track, because I've always contended that these state charges were completely concocted by the Biden DOJ, and basically the state prosecutors were acting as proxies and at the behest of the Biden DOJ. And that's really what became clear in reading the Arctic Frost documents, because the memo that created the investigation was all based on the electors, and it specifically said, even though actions took place in the states, the proper venue is Washington, D.C., the federal government, and that's why there should be a federal investigation. So to me, that just validates our belief that is documented in a 15-page pardon memo from Ed Martin, that everyone on the list who was pardoned was engaged. They were there because of the electors. That's a constitutional role. It has nothing. These state prosecutors, I cannot stress enough, they made up, they fabricated laws and charges, laws that they contend were broken. And that it was all just completely fabricated. And so I'm really proud of the president for standing up and issuing the pardons. I'm proud of Ed Martin for having the courage internally and externally to push for that this justice be done. And now I want the investigation to get underway, to find out the role of exactly how all of these four state Democrat AGs and the Democrat Fannie Willis in Fulton County, Georgia, how they were orchestrated. We need to prosecute. We need prosecutions of these people and their intent. And I received on Saturday, I'll just stop with this, from Christina Bobb, who was a reporter at the time of the election. She didn't even go to Arizona, but she was indicted in Arizona. She's now an attorney with Judicial Watch, and she filed an 8-page whistleblower complaint that shows that Chris Mays, who is the attorney general, the Democrat attorney general of Arizona, how she was basically, she was just doing the bidding of Norm Eisen, who was working with the Justice Department, and how after she filed, or right, just after she had filed the criminal indictments in Arizona, that somehow Chris Mays received a $200,000 contribution to her reelection campaign from a left-wing group associated with and founded and run by the Democrat Attorney General's Association, when before they'd given her $25,000. That was the maximum they'd given before. And how Norm Eisen is associated with the group that gave the money to Chris Mays' reelection campaign. And Norm Eisen and his 501c3 actually wrote the charging memo and the briefing and did all of the legal work that they concocted to bring the charges in Arizona. So now Judicial Watch is also seeking documents from Wisconsin and Michigan and Nevada, piecing together that this was all concocted, fabricated, and orchestrated by the Biden regime.
Wow. And there is so much corruption, I believe, that is yet to be uncovered. And the Arctic Frost investigation is maybe the tipping point of finally getting to the truth here. But it's very important, Cleta, to see how all of these state level attorneys general and prosecutors were working at the behest of the Biden administration in terms of what the pardons practically implicate legally, because what I've received from, you know, a number of reporters and, you know, questions, of course, this morning is, well, these were state level charges. How does a presidential pardon apply?
Well, I think it's really important to read the memo that and send it to any reporter who asks you the questions. Tell them read the pardon memo. 15 pages. Number one, it documents the problems of the 2020 election. It isn't just a screed. It is actual factual recounting of here are the facts that gave rise to the actions in the state. And then there's a very thorough analysis of the constitutional role of the electors, which are not state actors. These are federal positions. The Constitution of the United States and the Federal Electoral Count Act of 1887 governs what the electors do. So the federal law and the Constitution preempt these state charges. They should never have been brought in the first place under state law. And if you read the memo that Christopher Wray wrote to Merrick Garland in April of 2022 to open Arctic Frost, and you read the FBI opening memo saying we've gotten approval to open this sensitive investigative matter, it specifically states in the FBI and DOJ documents that even though these actions of the electors took place in these five states, these are really federal in nature, and venue is appropriate in Washington, D.C. So none of the reporters who are calling and asking you that question have read the first word of the pardon memo. They haven't read the first word of the Arctic Frost documents. They need to go read those, and that's what you should tell them. Have you read the FBI's opening memo as to when they opened the investigation under Arctic Frost? And there's a whole discussion of why this was federal. The electors are federal, even though the actions took place in the states. All of this was federal. But what happened, here's what I think happened, Jen. I think that the facts will bear me out on this. I think that what happened was when Arctic Frost was opened, the whole premise of it, the predication, which is what it's called in FBI language, was the electors and the actions that took place in the states. And again, the memo says, even though the actions took place in the states, these are federal in nature. And I think that what happened was that things just didn't move quickly enough for Jack Smith. Remember, Arctic Frost was opened in April of 2022. And in November of 2022, President Trump announces he is running for reelection. Well, all of a sudden, now Jack Smith is really under a clock. Because his intent, the Biden regime was intent upon indicting, trying, and convicting President Trump before the 2024 election. And he was hell-bent to get that done. And I think what he realized is, along the way, the people who were orchestrating this realized, we don't have time to do all of the electors and the president, everybody in Washington, D.C., we need to reorganize. And I think that's when they concocted with Norm Eisen and probably others, maybe Mark Elias, to have the state AGs and Fannie Willis bring charges against the electors, the lawyers, everybody associated with the president, and to get those brought under state law so that Jack Smith could focus on getting the president indicted and tried and convicted before November of 2024. I think that they decided they needed to split the workload. And so you literally had Norm Eisen, who is working at the highest level of he was a former DOJ attorney. He very close to Obama and Biden and everybody in that DOJ legal world controlled by the very far left of the Democratic Party. And he was very open about we could do all this at the state level. And he literally proceeded to just implement the charges. And we know that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade went to Washington, met at the White House before she filed the charges in August of 2023. So I think that, you know, I've been begging the DOJ and anyone that will listen to go through the DOJ archives and to find all of the communications and documentations that show there was coordination and control by the Biden DOJ of these state prosecutions.
And I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell, who's the senior legal fellow for the Conservative Partnership Institute. You can follow her at Cleta Mitchell, and you really need to read her article on this in The Federalist that is online now. And Cleta, it never ceases to amaze me how the Democrats do always exactly what they falsely accuse Republicans of doing. That's their MO. But I think that your perspective and how you're viewing this and how the facts bear out is accurate. And just in my own experience with speaking, you know, first being subpoenaed by the DOJ, and then after that was all of the states and how wide sweeping it was across the states. I mean, even in Arizona, where they dismissed the indictment as to me with basically an apology saying, you know, you shouldn't have been included here at all. But it was so wide sweeping. Part of that, just in my own experience and how I viewed the difference between the attorneys on the state level versus the federal DOJ. People may not necessarily like this, but my perspective of at least the lawyers who were just the career DOJ prosecutors, not the political ones at the highest levels, but the ones that were actually tasked with doing some of these interviews. I was actually impressed with the level of detail of the DOJ lawyers and how they wanted to get it right. And it may be that they realized they weren't getting it right. And who knows if there was some kind of internal pushback, but the difference between the level of detail on that level versus how wide sweeping the states were to just anybody who's remotely associated with Trump, let's just include them. The states, I think, were willing to do what maybe some in the DOJ were not.
Well, I don't know that I would. I think the DOJ, I'm not giving any passes to the Biden DOJ. You're more generous than I am. Jenna,
well, some of them worked prior to Biden. So that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's the highest level. Right. I think, you know, I think some of them who were there tasked with this, you know, that were actually trying to do their job.
Plus let's be clear here. The states conducted no investigations. They really right. didn't have any investigation. All the facts, quote unquote facts, what they did, I believe very strongly that this will all come out. Hopefully it will come out. Hopefully the Trump DOJ is actually working on following through on this. But I think that what happened was that the FBI investigations and the DOJ investigations were just turned over to the states. And they, you know, as I said, Christina Bob, who was not in Arizona, that's the thing. And she was also swept into it by mistake. But mm-hmm. But she's a Marine JAG attorney. She's no slouch. But she did all this research. And it shows that that Norm Eisen swept in. He has this organization called States United for Democracy. And he came in, brought his traveling roadshow to Arizona, and they just, I'm sure that they just wanted to sweep in anybody that was close to President Trump, mm-hmm. whether they had anything to do with Arizona or not. And I don't think that the attorneys in the Democrat AG's offices, they didn't have any idea what was going on. They had no facts. They had conducted no investigation. None of this was their idea. So I think it's very interesting, your perspective on that, having dealt with both the DOJ attorneys and the state attorneys, the attorneys from the state AG's office, because I don't think they had a clue about what was going on. Their boss just was asked by the people at the Biden administration to file these charges. And I think that's what happened. That's what happened in two of the states. In Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Attorney General said publicly, there is no state law under which I could prosecute the electors. He said that publicly. And the Attorney General of Nevada said in May of 2023, and again in September of 2023, Aaron Ford, the Democrat Attorney General of Nevada, said, there's no state law that I can where I can prosecute these electors. And then somehow between having said that twice publicly and then between September and December of 2023, then he files charges against the electors. And then that was dismissed because because it was the wrong venue. The court granted the dismissal. He appealed. That was just heard. That appeal was just heard in August. And then last year, just before the statute of limitations expired, he came up with another set of charges and charged the electors with forgery. Well, they didn't forge anything. They signed their own names. I mean, that's how crazy these charges are. And so I want the rest of the story. The picture is beginning to emerge. I want the facts from the Biden regime's work, and how Norm Eisen and others just they took facts and then shoehorned facts into trying to come up with a crime, which is the opposite. It is the opposite of the way things are supposed to work. First, you are supposed to identify a prosecutor. This is basic criminal procedure 101, freshman year in law school. First, you identify a crime that's been committed, and then you ascertain whether there are facts that support that this person committed that crime. That is the opposite of what was done in all these state cases. So I refuse to allow this to be called state prosecutions, or in the case of Fannie Willis, she filed under state law in Georgia. I refuse to accept that. I won't even allow the language. I always put state in quotes because I don't think these were state proceedings at all. They were proxies being done on behalf of and at the behest of the Biden DOJ.
Well, we have to take a break here, but so much more to unpack, Cleta Mitchell. So hopefully we can have you on the podcast soon, maybe to talk about this more in depth, because I agree with you. I think that the full truth is just barely starting to come out. And I hope that the full truth, the entire scope, because truth is the best disinfectant, sunlight is the best disinfectant, will come out, and there will be accountability for everyone involved who actually did wrong in this situation, instead of simply pursuing people because they were associated to President Trump. So thank you, Cleta, for your work on this. Thank you to President Trump, to Ed Martin, to everyone else involved. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby, to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today.
Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So, interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal this week. Genetically engineered babies are banned, but tech titans are trying to make one anyway. Startups funded by some of the most powerful billionaires in Silicon Valley are pushing the boundaries of reproductive genetics, hoping to prevent diseases as well as improve the chances for high IQ and other preferred traits. So, for months, this article says, a small company in San Francisco has been pursuing a secretive project, the birth of a genetically engineered baby. This is backed by OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman and his quote-unquote husband, along with Coinbase co-founder and CEO Brian Armstrong. And the startup is called Preventative. So very interesting that this is all backed by OpenAI and some of these tech titans. But basically what this comes down to is commodifying children and genetic selection. This is, we know, completely unethical. So why is it still happening, especially in the United States? Well, joining me to discuss is our dear friend Katie Faust, who is the president of Them Before Us. And Katie, this stuff, you know, along with, you know, IVF and medical technical quote unquote advancements often aren't actually advancements. They're more like Frankenstein in nature. Why is this still happening in the United States?
Well, the truth is this really is not happening in the United States. What Sam Altman and this new company is attempting to do is actually illegal. It is prohibited in the United States to genetically edit embryos. Now, there's a lot of horrifying things that are allowed in the name of reproductive technologies. We already have companies like Orchid that will allow complete genome screenings of embryos so that you can discard the undesirables, or the ones that don't have the kind of characteristics, or the ones that might be at risk for things like early baldness or some kinds of blindness. I mean, so it's perfectly legal to get rid of undesirable embryos. What's not yet legal in the United States is what Altman and this new company is seeking to do, which is edit the embryo. So take one embryo and change the chromosomal makeup, edit the genes of the baby in the name, of course, of being sort of therapeutic or restorative, where they're trying to edit out something that's gone wrong with the child. But very, very clearly, this could be used to design a custom ordered baby in the future. So I believe that they're looking at taking this off site right now. This, what they're doing right now, is exploratory. But if they actually wanted to implement this, they would need to go to places that are not in the United States, that do not have the kind of regulations that we have around gene editing. So they're looking at places like the UAE.
Wow. And, you know, even this description of preferred traits, I find that so offensive to the notion of recognizing human value as made in God's image, and suggesting that we as human beings can have any say whatsoever as to a preference of a preferred trait. Because just because I may think in my limited scope that someone would benefit from a certain trait, or I would want a child to have a certain aptitude or a certain look, this is completely disrespectful and disregarding the entire diversity of the human population, and the fact that God made us unique, but he also made us one human race with simply some variances and some differences. And so the fact that there are even so-called preferred traits, I find that just, like I said, very offensive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You need to listen to the kind of language that people use. Not just around things like gene editing, but just around things like routinely making babies in a laboratory. I want a girl. I don't want a boy. Oh, I need to screen for Down syndrome. I need to do this pre-genetic testing. What are you doing? You're saying, I am only going to welcome a certain kind of child. And the vast majority of IVF clinics have sex selection, have pre-implantation screening, about 75% of each. Some people will choose IVF because not because they're infertile, but because they want to choose the traits of their child, not just medically related, but we have the ability to screen for things like eye color. And of course, these total genome screenings are getting closer and closer to the possibility of screening for things like IQ. And so we're moving into a world, not just, again, where you're eliminating the undesirable embryos, but now this next step of gene editing means you can actually build a baby, build the baby that you want by altering their genes before implantation so that you can get the product that you're looking for. So you're exactly right. This is actually a misunderstanding of what it means to be a human, that we are not items to be awarded and designed by other humans. We are made in the image of God. God alone makes life, God alone takes life, and God alone forms that life together, ideally in the child's mother's own womb.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Katie Faust, and her excellent book is Them Before Us. You really need to read this on the rights of the child and the whole concept and notion of these reproductive genetics being a selective and these preferred traits really do go to the commodification of children as if they are somehow a possession of the adult parent or guardian. And I don't like to say parent for everyone, because people who just simply purchase children, especially in the context of, two men or two women. I mean, we need to have legislation in the states and on the federal level that recognizes that every child has uniquely one and only one mother and one and only one father. And so while guardianship, some of those things are different, the rights of parents are being completely misunderstood and are being broadened, but also the rights of the child are then being narrowed, because when you add preferences to a product that you are designing like you would an automobile or a house, then you are putting children in that same category instead of recognizing that parents are not owners of children. Children belong to parents only in the sense that parents, true parents, are responsible for the care and upbringing and the shepherding and the discipling until those children become adults and then are responsible for themselves. But it's not an ownership. And what I find so bizarre, Katie, is how these types of groups are lauded often, by the left, who are the very same ones who would suggest to, Republicans and conservatives that somehow, we're the racist, sexist ones because we go along with God's design for the family and say, only one man and one woman united in marriage, and somehow that's offensive to them, when they're the ones who are literally trying to select and prefer the skin color, hair color, and eye color of children. I mean, that is, and gender, that's actual racism and sexism.
That's exactly right. It's so well stated. And this understanding of who has a right to who, do parents have a right to their children? Yes, you have a right to your own children. You do not have a right to design and purchase children from other adults. And it's no coincidence that Sam Altman has had a child through surrogacy with his so-called husband. And if you believe that you can purchase a child's genetic mother from an egg donor catalog and rent another womb from the child's birth mother and intentionally create a motherless child, well, then why not take it a step further and genetically improve the baby? And so we do need to get back to, like, not just decrying gene editing, not just decrying the kind of total embryo screening that would allow us to discard undesirable babies before implantation. We need to get back to the place where we understand that children have a right to their own mother and father. And nobody else's sperm, egg, or womb should ever be used when you're talking about begetting children, because you very quickly move from begetting to manufacturing. When you take this child creation out of the marital embrace and you put it into the hands of a technician, then of course they are a product that can be ordered according to your desires, not according to the child's fundamental rights.
Yeah, and I hope that there will be more legislation on the federal level, but also especially on the state level, that will prevent a lot of this commodification of children, including even surrogacy. And, you know, for, I know that President Trump, you know, is very concerned about infertile couples and trying, you know, to help. And that's very well intentioned. But the reality is that there is so much of this commodification going on. And even to the extent, Katie, that we have in our society largely removed the understanding and the awe of God creating life in his time and for his purposes and every unique human being that ultimately belongs to him for our own preferences. I mean, even to the extent that I've heard people, even among Christians suggesting, which this is horrible, but suggesting that, well, you know, even fertile married couples should consider surrogacy because then that relieves the quote unquote burden of pregnancy from the mother. And I'm thinking, you're sidestepping God's design. I mean, what are you even talking about? And so this whole idea in our society that we've made this acceptable, really, we have a lot of work in the culture to do, but we also have a lot of work in the legislature to do. And so do you know if any legislative bills or, you know, anything that is dealing with some of these issues is currently being considered among the state legislatures?
We're going to propose some. I'll tell you that much. We actually have a policy group right now that are working on some recommendations for state level lawmakers to outlaw the buying and selling of third parties in reproduction, because it really is the buying and selling of children. And that will include a third party womb. Because whenever you take a step away from natural procreation, what you're actually saying is children need to pay the price for something that I want. Children need to lose their mother or lose their father or lose the bond with their birth mother. They need to lose their right to life because they're edited or screened out of existence. It's always children that pay the price when we reject God's design for the family, whether that is the permanence and, you know, by embracing no-fault divorce, whether it's rejecting mothers or fathers in the name of gay marriage, or whether it's rejecting having God make the baby and not a fertility doctor. Kids always pay the price when we step away from God's design. And as Christians, we should be primarily concerned with justice for the least of these. And unfortunately, in the area of marriage and family, and especially reproductive technologies, we are seeing injustice for the very least of all of us, like unborn children that cannot fight for themselves. So yes, be on the lookout next year for new policy recommendations on a variety of different states that are going to stop the commodification of children in the name of even just in the name of helping infertile couples. Like, no child should be bought, sold, commodified, deleted out of existence just because an adult really wants something.
Yeah, and I know that here at AFA Action, we're also working on legislation and also contemplating, you know, how to address some of these issues because it's so incredibly important. And these issues need to be addressed with recognizing that this is the pro-life position overall. It's not just related to babies that are already conceived and protecting them in the womb. This is about protecting life even before conception and understanding that the circumstances surrounding conception must be ethical, and it must go along with a biblical worldview, a truthful worldview, and with children's rights first, because every human being has the same inherent dignity and value. So Katie, I really appreciate what you're doing and calling attention to this issue, because I think that when a lot of people hear about things, you know, like President Trump's IVF executive order, they think very top level and not to all of these implications and these ethical concerns involved. And they're thinking, well, why isn't that a good thing that, you know, we can help people who are or couples who are infertile? And they automatically maybe in their mind kind of go to this this place that they think, oh, okay, the example that I'm thinking is, you know, maybe this couple at church that's a man and a woman in the bonds of marriage that are infertile, and they're thinking that that's the only scenario. And so we're already out of time, so I won't ask you to answer another question in 30 seconds, but overall, this has really broad implications. You really need to follow Katie Faust. She also has her show here on American Family Radio Network on the weekend. You can find that at AFR.net. And you can support the work that she's doing at Them Before Us and also at AFA Action. So thanks so much, Katie, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, I promised we would get to the government shutdown, and here we are. But this coming from the BBC, the U.S. Senate passes deal aimed at ending longest ever government shutdown. So after a weekend of negotiations in Washington, a minority of Democrats joined with Republicans and voted in favor of an agreement. The vote is a procedural first step towards passing a compromise to fund the government since it ran out of money on October 1st. So it will still need to clear several more hurdles, including a vote from the House of Representatives before all of this can go back. And so, you know, I personally am very disappointed that this is the way that the government shutdown is ending, instead of Republicans just kind of growing a spine and saying, you know what, we actually are in the majority in both houses and we can end the filibuster. We can move to a vote on a budget and we don't have to continue all of this negotiation. Because likely this would only fund the government until, according to reports, about January 30th, 31st of next year. So they're still going, the Democrats are still going to push for everything that they want. And why are they even pushing or thinking that they can push for anything? Well, because even though they're in the minority, Republicans are letting them. So let's welcome in Orrin McIntyre to continue to rant with me, who is a host at The Blaze and someone you should definitely follow on X. So, Orrin, are you as disappointed as I am in Republicans?
Pretty much perpetually, but specifically now, yes, for sure. We have a scenario where, you know, the Republicans knew what they were getting into. Everyone understood that this was going to be a showdown. And of course, the key to any game of chicken is making sure the other side knows that you won't blink. That's the first thing you need to ensure when you go into a scenario like this. Republicans were given the opportunity to, you know, scale back the federal government quite a bit, and yet they curtailed that option as well. And so ultimately you have this scenario where you kind of wonder, what did you ultimately get out of this? You go through all of the bad optics of the shutdown and everything, but ultimately you don't have the confidence to pull the trigger and solve the issue. As you say, ultimately you kind of appear to back down at the end of the day and don't really get any concrete win after months of this. And this is, of course, a big problem because there's only so much time in any given presidential administration. Every minute you waste on something like this that just becomes completely useless is a minute you could have been using to advance some other policy issue, some other cause. So it's just very frustrating to yet again see a large amount of political momentum squandered for what amounts to basically nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I really have no particular optimism that it's going to be any different when we get to the end of, you know, this kind of stopgap that Republicans are not going to negotiate with Democrats. And I don't think that they'll give them, you know, health care for people who are here illegally. I mean, I think that would just utterly destroy any shred of reputation they have left. So, I mean, I don't think they're going to go that far, but I think that Democrats are asking for things that they know Republicans won't provide so that they can ask for the things they really want, which will be the compromise issues, which is, I think, ultimately what happened here. And so we also are just a few weeks, actually, you know, a week ago tomorrow, that the elections on November 4th were held, and that, I think, was part of what the Democrats were holding out on, because it's no real surprise that literally the weekend after those elections, now suddenly the Democrats are coming forward and saying, oh, okay, you know, now we're willing to compromise. I mean, it seems like everything is just on their terms.
Yeah, and it's amazing because, again, Republicans can win elections, control everything, and still somehow get dictated to by the minority party. And this is why so many people are entirely frustrated with the legislative branch in general. That's why they kind of just look to the president to solve everything, even if that's not constitutionally his job, because, you know, Republican Congress is just so completely useless. Republican legislators are just so incapable of getting anything done since the Big Beautiful Bill. That you end up in this scenario where, you know, you just basically have to hope executive action can kind of cut through the red tape and and solve everything. So we end up in the scenario where any action taken basically happens under, you know, the auspices of a executive order. Nothing is lasting. Nothing stays relevant over time. And people get this learned helplessness when it comes to electing Republican politicians.
Yeah, 100%. Orrin McIntyre, and he's a host at The Blaze. You can follow him on X at Orrin McIntyre. And so where do you think this ultimately goes from here then? I mean, we're going to have to pass ultimately the budget at some point. And so we're now then getting into next year, and the Democrats will be looking at the midterms. Republicans should be, if they're smart. Negotiations happening, not happening before that deadline? What's your prediction?
I imagine ultimately that the Democrats are going to continue to, you know, kind of hold things hostage. I don't really see a lot of negotiation, a lot of wiggle room. I think that ultimately they've just become obstinate and are uninterested in, you know, the business of running the government so much as opposing Donald Trump. You know, giving Trump anything he wants is the worst thing possible. And of course, they feel like they're in the position where if they can't get everything, they can at least dictate a shocking amount of the process. So that would be my prediction.
All right. Well, we'll see what ultimately happens. And, you know, maybe Republicans will surprise us. I kind of doubt it, but, you know, we'll see. But I wanted to get your take before we run out of time on one other issue. Trump has also suggested that he is pushing for a 50-year mortgage to incentivize home ownership and also provide a way, according to him, for those who may otherwise not be able to afford homes to not just have the option of a 30-year mortgage, but a 50-year. I am very much against this because if you look at actually the breakdown of the costs, really, I mean, you know, 50 years, if somebody buys it, a home at, you know, even age 30, which is about the median right now, then you're basically renting from the bank until you're 80 years old. And the margins, if you actually do the math, the margin of how much lower the mortgage payment would be monthly compared to how much time, 20% equity to get rid of, you know, the PMI, all of that, all of those numbers that go into this, there's really ultimately not that much benefit. It's not like you take a $3,000 mortgage and you're only paying, you know, $800 a month. I mean, that's something, the affordability of houses is what we should be focused on, I think, not just trying to extend even more payments with basically doubling the interest over that period of time. So what do you think, Orrin, that Trump is actually going for here?
Well, on one level, you can completely understand what he's trying to do. You know, houses have become incredibly unaffordable, especially for young Americans. You know, they don't have access to the American dream. They have difficulty starting families and starting lives and gaining independence because, you know, they just can't get into the real estate market. And, you know, if you extend the mortgage payments, then technically you bring down the monthly costs. So at some level, you get where Trump is trying to go. But ultimately, you're correct. This is the wrong type of solution because once you start getting beyond 30 years, I mean, remember, the standard home loan used to be 20 years. Then it became 30 years. We see the same thing with all types of debt. You know, the standard car loan used to be 2 to 3 years. Now it's at least 5, sometimes 7 that it gets stretched to. And so what we're really doing is ultimately like subsidizing this inflation, because what we're doing is putting more and more people who otherwise would not qualify into the system, and we're making sure that they pay extended amounts. And this, of course, drives up the amount that any given home is going to cost. I think you're right that affordability is the key. And of course, the first step in helping with affordability should be deporting illegal immigrants. Reducing the amount of demand, the pressure on the system would be the most helpful, and it would also be a completion of one of Trump's promises when it came to the campaign. Now, there are other options like removing barriers to permitting and making sure that we can build more homes more effectively. I think we could reduce the ability of investments and foreign corporations in the ability to purchase homes, residential real estate in the United States to keep them from creating artificial demand. But when you have a 50-year mortgage, you are basically just a peasant. It's basically just feudalism, except the bank doesn't even have the responsibility to protect you from Vikings. You're just locked into a piece of land stand your entire life and you die in debt.
Yeah. And I mean, so well said. And it is just, it is really just subsidizing inflation. And it's just encouraging Americans, instead of actually outright owning our property, owning our possessions or commodities, to just continue to basically pay rent perpetually and be in debt perpetually for an overextended time period, instead of actually making things affordable. So we're already out of time, but you know, this is a topic we need to dive deeper into soon. So hopefully we'll have you back on again soon. Orrin McIntyre, everyone, again, follow him on X and also at The Blaze. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.